Hi friends! A short message before we start the episode. Every time we meet a new scientist, we love to chat with him or her over a good coffee or tea. So if you like the show and want to support our work, here are two ways to do it. The first one is to go on our page, Buy Me a Coffee, by following the link in the show notes, and to offer us a coffee. Simple, effective, and we won't forget to thank you. The second way is just as simple. Just share your opinion about the episode on Twitter by tagging us at LonelyPipette. We won't miss to answer you. Thanks again for the sharing and à bientôt.
So that's one paradigm shift, I think, is this idea of shifting from like an investigator-initiated model to a community-initiated model. You know, what do we need as a community? And then as a community, let's go find the right people to do it. That's one paradigm shift. The other paradigm shift, which I didn't mention in my journey, but is really critical to mention, is that I knew I couldn't develop a new drug from scratch. I knew my disease was going to continue to relapse every few months, and I was going to die very shortly. I didn't have $1 billion in 10 years to come up with a new drug. I had a very simple realization, and that was the only way I survive is if I find a drug that's already on the pharmacy shelf, like, period.
Are you working in research, trying to do the best science you can?
Are you a team leader, a research assistant, postdoc, PhD student, or any other type of scientist?
Are you looking for a place where you can sit, relax, and listen to inspiring people?
Well, we have good news for you. You've just found what you're looking for.
Hi everybody, my name is Renaud Pourpre.
And I am Jonathan Weitzman.
Welcome to the Lonely Pipette,
helping scientists
do better science.
My name is David Fagenbaum. I work in translational research at the University of Pennsylvania, and I feel thrilled to share my tips with the Lonely Pipette.
So David Fagenbaum studied in Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and then at the University of Oxford in the UK, before training as a doctor at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. While he was in medical school, David became critically ill with idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease. After his third relapse in 2012, he co-founded the Castleman Disease Collaboration Network and began conducting research into Castleman disease. In 2015, he joined the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania as an assistant professor of medicine and associate director of the Orphan Disease Center. He is the founding director of the Center for Cytokine Storm Treatment and Laboratory, which focuses on hyperinflammatory diseases. Fagenbaum discovered increased mTOR signaling in Castleman disease and began testing an mTOR inhibitor on himself to assess its efficiency. Now he is spreading this approach to other diseases and co-founded Every Cure in 2022 to unlock the full potential of every drug to treat every disease possible. His book, Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action, was a national bestseller. David was one of the youngest professors to receive tenure at Penn Med, and he was recognized on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. David, thanks for coming to share your tips with the Lonely Pipette.
Jonathan, thanks so much for having me.
And David, thank you very much for being with us today. I have to say that when I looked at your profile and your career, I was just like amazed by your story. And it's really an honor for us to have you to a little bit dive into your personal story and your career here. We have a special question always to start our podcast because we see scientists a little bit as heroes. So we would like to dive a little bit into your origin story. So can you tell us what was the spark that ignited your passion around a career in science?
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I so appreciate your kind words of support. I think the first spark occurred actually when I was 18 years old, and my mom was diagnosed with brain cancer. And I learned that she had this form of cancer that had no existing treatments. The treatments in development were unlikely to be helpful for her. And it devastated me. And then it turned me on a mission to say, oh my gosh, there are diseases, and this at the time, this is 2003, diseases out there where there are no treatments. This is unacceptable. You know, I'm going to dedicate my life to trying to discover drugs for people like her. So her diagnosis is really what started me on this mission. But as you know, my journey has had a few more sparks, I guess, along the way. But that really, if you ask what was the first moment, it was, you know, we've got to develop treatments for devastating conditions like brain cancer.
So we're sorry that it started with your mom's disease. But if you hadn't become a scientist, what do you think you would have been?
I think that I probably still would have gone into medicine. I think maybe I would have been more of a clinical physician. I think I always was interested in medicine and health and disease. But it was my mom's diagnosis and the realization that if the drugs don't exist, the doctors can't treat it, that really led me to want to become a scientist so I can help to develop and identify those drugs.
You were also a footballer at some point, right?
I was, yeah, an American footballer. That's right. Yeah, I played quarterback at Georgetown. And for those people across the pond, Georgetown is not known for our football. Just by the way, we're known for other sports. Football is not one of them. but it was an incredible experience. And truthfully, I learned a lot from playing college football and a lot from being a part of a team like that, that I use every day in the way I manage my center and my lab here at Penn.
That's great. Wow. So there's this strong personal passion at the beginning. The career, as all careers go up and down, are there any points where you've had doubts and thought you might give it all in and go and do something else?
You know, what I've been focused on has changed a bit over the years. So with my mom's diagnosis, I said, I want to go into science. I want to develop drugs for patients like her. And you know, I went to England for grad school for a year and then came back to Penn for medical school. And I decided to do medical school because I believed that the medical degree would be helpful as I went on this journey of drug development. But while I was in medical school, I sort of started to fall in love with clinical care. And so I said, gosh, maybe I'll just, you know, be a straightforward, you know, clinical oncologist and maybe not get that involved in research. So I guess I would say that my interest in research, you know, peaked with my mom's illness, and then it was sort of becoming more clinical. And then, as you know, in my own personal case, when I got very sick with this disease, Castleman disease, that gave me this newfound personal desire to get involved in research. So yes, my goal went from research to clinical care back to research. But since I went back to research when I was 25, it has only gotten stronger and stronger by the day.
That's the perfect transition for the next question we had for you, actually, because we wanted for you to tell us a little bit more about your story about finding a cure for Castleman disease. Can you share a little bit of this huge path?
Sure.
With us?
Absolutely. So I was a healthy third year medical student. I wanted to be an oncologist, like I mentioned earlier, in memory of my mom. My interest in research was sort of waning a bit, and I was, you know, focusing more on clinical care. And out of nowhere, I became more ill than I even thought was possible. My liver, my kidneys, my bone marrow, my heart, and my lungs all began to fail. I went from literally delivering babies on my OBGYN rotation, which you could argue is almost like a pinnacle point of medical school, right? Bringing life into the world, to within just a few weeks being in the intensive care unit in the exact same hospital, having my last rites read to me by a priest because my doctors were sure that I was going to die. And it happened so quickly. It took 11 weeks to make the diagnosis. I spent in the intensive care unit. And over the course of those 11 weeks, we didn't know what it was that was killing me. I gained 70 pounds [S2] Wow. [S1] Of fluid. I drifted in and out of consciousness. I needed daily transfusions of red blood cells and platelets just to keep me alive. And finally, the diagnosis came in of idiopathic multicenter Castleman disease, which most listeners probably have never heard of. But an easy way to think about IMCD is it's a cytokine storm, your immune system becoming hyperactivated for an unknown cause. And that cytokine storm causes severe multi-organ system failure. So when I'm in the ICU with my disease, I look like I have sepsis or I have, you know, the most severe infection you've ever seen. And so all of my organs shut down. I got a good amount of chemotherapy, which got my disease into remission. But I kept having a relapse after relapse. I failed to respond to an IL-6 blocker, which was the only drug in development. There were no more clinical trials. There were no more promising leads. When I failed IL-6 blockade, that was it. But so in terms of, you know, my journey, that was a real turning point for me. When I went from being this sort of hopeful medical student who believed that, you know, there must be drugs in development, there must be researchers working together collaboratively. In my book, I call it the Santa Claus theory of science. And that's that I sort of naively believed that there were teams of researchers sort of working together collaboratively around the world, kind of like
on Santa every disease.
And his elves on every disease.
Yeah.
And that, you know, solutions were being found as quickly as possible, and that the only thing holding back progress was technology. How quickly can we develop the technology? That was the leading edge, and that cures were sort of right at that edge. What I've learned subsequently is that there are no Santa's workshops. You know, there are a few diseases where there truly are the equivalents, where there is that sort of international collaboration. But for the vast majority of diseases, particularly rare diseases, it's a lot of sort of happenstance, a lot of randomness that leads to a drug moving forward. And so that's when I decided to dedicate my career to trying to find, or my life, not just my career, my life, to trying to find a treatment for this disease. And that journey progressed into me collecting blood samples for myself and storing them in the freezer in the lab in the weeks leading up to my last relapse, and then surviving thanks to a lot of chemotherapy, but then going back to the lab and performing flow cytometry on my PBMCs, serum proteomics on my serum, immunohistochemistry on my lymph node tissue, which all converged on a discovery that I made, and that's that there's increased mTOR signaling in my immune system, and also we've now discovered in other Castleman's patients' immune systems. And so I tested an mTOR inhibitor on myself, and it's been over 9.5 years. I've been doing great on it.
Yeah, I must say, so we're on audio only, but you look great. No, unbelievable.
I feel great.
So mTOR is the key?
It's the key for me. So what we've discovered is that there's increased mTOR signaling uniformly across patients with idiopathic multicenter Castleman disease. As you and all your listeners know, there are many times where you find increased signaling or increased activation of some pathway, but inhibiting it is not effective, right? We see that all the time in biology. What we found is that it's uniformly increased across all patients, but that somewhere around 20% of us respond really well to mTOR inhibition. The rest of us, we've got sky-high levels of mTOR activation, but inhibiting it doesn't seem to make any difference. And so presumably there's some sort of bypass pathway, or maybe it's just some sort of epiphenomenon of the hyperinflammatory state we're in. But for me, it turns out that turning mTOR off prevents this entire cytokine storm from emerging.
So how did you convince your doctors? Because they presumably had told you
this is it.
There's nothing to do. And you did all these tests and then found the inhibitor. How did they respond?
So a few of my doctors, or a couple of them, weren't willing to entertain the idea at all. They said, you know, David, this is it. Go spend time with your fiance, Caitlin, go be with your family, stop doing all these experiments in the lab. You're not going to find anything. You're just wasting your time. So a couple of my doctors told me to do that. A couple of them were sort of interested, show me whatever data you have. And one of those doctors who was interested to see what I came up with was actually at the NIH. And so I did all the serum proteomics. I did this enrichment analyses, found this mTOR signature. I had had a lymph node cut out during my last relapse. I asked my doctor to get a lymph node out, so that way if I survived, I'd have some tissue to work on. And so got the lymph node out, and I did a really cheap immunohistochemistry stain for phospho-S6, which is this really reliable marker for mTOR activation. And it came back just blazingly positive compared to all the controls I ran it on. And so I got in my car and I drove down to Washington, D.C. I live in Philadelphia and I was in medical school at Penn at the time. And so I drove down to Washington, D.C. and I met with my doctor in the lobby of NIH. And I didn't even, I wasn't seeing him in a clinical visit. I didn't have an appointment. I literally just met him outside the Aubon Payne in Bethesda at NIH. And I just, put the data across the table and I showed it to him. And I said, what do you think? He said, we've got no other options. And so if I had any other options, I'd probably try them because who knows if this is going to be helpful. But we really don't have any other options. So, I'm willing to prescribe an mTOR inhibitor and let's see what happens. And so you took that leap of faith and here we are over 9.5 years later.
Did you, seeing this period now with much more time behind you, Did you see a lot of restraint for you to go there and try all those hypotheses, or And if yes, how did you convince yourself to keep going and try to decipher this mysterious way to cure your disease?
Yeah, it's a great question. So for me, you know, I was a third year medical student. As we discussed, I had dreamed of being a scientist and being a part of identifying and developing treatments, but I frankly wasn't that qualified. My master's at Oxford was all computational. It was no time in the wet lab. So, you know, I was a very lonely pipetter when I was in the lab, and I was certainly an inexperienced pipetter. You know, for me, I was engaged to Caitlin, and I wanted to get married to her. I wanted to have a family. I had, you know, put so much of my life into my training, and I wanted to, you know, maybe be a part of some discoveries that could help patients one day. And so I had this, you know, all these things in front of me that I wanted. And I think anytime you're dealing with any sort of challenge in life, I think you got to have something in front of you that you want and that you're chasing after. You know, if I was just like fighting to survive, I wouldn't have been able to. I mean, I didn't share. I nearly died.
It's a sort of a big Viktor Frankl thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spent over the course of 3 years, I spent almost an entire year in the intensive care unit. I nearly died 5 times. I sort of glazed over all the tough stuff, right? Jumped right to the part that I love, which is the science. But, you know, if I was just focused on survival, I wouldn't have survived. The fact that I was physically able to survive is sort of a miracle in itself. But really, it was, I had this vision for the future, which is I want to get married. I wanted to treat patients. I wanted to be with my family. I wanted to have a family. So the vision for the future. The second is that I had incredible support at my side. So my dad, my sisters, my girlfriend, Caitlin, my friends, they were relentless in their support. I mean, they never left my side. And I mentioned the scientific experiments I was running. I was turning to classmates of mine, some PhD students, and we were, you know, working on putting together assays. We were thinking through what the right study design should be. So I had this incredible support by my side. And then I think the third step, or third piece that helped me to get through this is it's a bit of a cliche, but it truly was one day at a time. It wasn't like, I'm going to cure my disease. It was, I'm going to set up this flow cytometry experiment. I'm going to do it today. And then the next day, it's like, I'm going to analyze the results from my experiment. And the next day, it's, I'm going to run a serum proteomics assay. It's, you know, it was one step at a time. And it was, yes, it was towards like finding a drug that could save my life, but it was one step at a time. And if I would have been completely overwhelmed by like, I'm going to need to cure my disease. And that was obviously the goal, but it really was one step at a time.
So it's a miracle in some ways. But do you think to what extent is a paradigm for other patients? Right? Did you get lucky, or is it that we don't throw enough energy at all these diseases? What is it?
I think I definitely got lucky, right? In a lot of ways, you know, the fact that I was able to uncover an mTOR signature from my serum proteomics, validated in the lab, get on an mTOR inhibitor in the matter of a couple weeks, right? I mean, that's sort of mind-blowing. And in hindsight, I'm like, oh my gosh, a lot of things had to line up for that to happen, right? And the truth is, they had to line up. If they didn't, I just wouldn't be here today, right? So it's sort of like all the things had to happen for me to be here. So it might seem like it's mind-blowing, but the reality is if they didn't all line up, I just wouldn't be here. So we wouldn't have heard the story. I think that there are a few really important lessons that I take away from my journey that I think are really widely applicable. So one of them is the importance of patients being a part of driving forward science. So I haven't talked yet about an initiative I started called the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, and I started that in the middle of all this journey, and that was a big part of the progress. I should have given a big nod to that because there were physicians and researchers around the world who were contributing ideas, who were helping to think through how do we solve this thing, and those were really foundational to the progress. But I think that what was different about our approach was that we created something called the collaborative network approach, where basically rather than raising money and then inviting researchers to apply for it, which is sort of the traditional way that we do research. We said, why don't we get all the physicians, researchers, and patients together and let's crowdsource from that community what research should be done, and then let's go out and figure out who's the best researcher in the world to do those studies. So let's not just invite a bunch of Castleman's researchers to apply to do things that those Castleman's researchers don't know how to do. Let's actually figure out what should be done, and let's go find the best pathogen hunter in the world. Let's go find the best person to do serum proteomics in the world. Let's figure out what should we do, and let's go proactively recruit them. Let's bring them in. So, and the key part of this is that it's patients are part of the process. And so patients are actually saying, yeah, we really want to identify a new treatment approach. We want diagnostic tests that are better. We want to be able to preserve our fertility. Things like that, that we're not thinking about when I wear my scientific hat. I'm not thinking about those things. When I wear my patient hat, I am thinking about those things. And so, and it certainly wasn't just me that was a patient perspective. So I think this idea of getting us all together to come up with what we should do and then figure out the best people to do it, it's a bit counter to the way that we all do science, right? You know, if I come up with an idea, I'm the one who gets to write the R01 for it because it was my idea. And I'm the one who gets to do the research because it was my idea. But wait a minute. What if there's someone better at doing the research? It may be my idea, but what if someone's better at doing it and it'd be better for patients if someone else does the research? That's the world and the paradigm that I think we need to be in.
So should we change the funding structure?
I think that there's a role for the current structure of investigator-initiated. And through the Castle Music Collaborative Network, 10% of the money we give out every year is through this model, the sort of the old school model of like, we've got money, who wants it, right? The other 90%, we go from the top of our list of prioritized studies and we say, okay, we've done number one, we've done number two, number three. We have prioritized doing a broad serum proteomic study across these diseases. Let's go find the right group to do it. And actually we find ourselves turning into companies quite often because over the years we found that companies or CROs have been able to deliver results more quickly and in some cases, maybe even more effectively than some of our academic colleagues. And I don't say that in any sort of a negative way. Of course I'm an academic, but just to say that we found that, when we have a very clear idea for what needs to be done, we've had a lot of success with working directly with companies to actually get those things done. So that's one paradigm shift, I think, is this idea of shifting from like an investigator initiated model to a community initiated model. You know, what do we need as a community? And then as a community, let's go find the right people to do it. That's one paradigm shift. The other paradigm shift, which I didn't mention in my journey, but is really critical to mention, is that I knew I couldn't develop a new drug from scratch. I knew my disease was going to continue to relapse every few months, and I was going to die very shortly. I didn't have $1 billion in 10 years to come up with a new drug. I had a very simple realization, and that was the only way I survive is if I find a drug that's already on the pharmacy shelf, like, period. It's got to be something that is already there. So my work in the lab was fully focused on trying to understand what is happening in my immune system that could be targetable with an existing drug. And the good part about having an immune disorder is that there are a lot of drugs that modulate the immune system. I mean, literally dozens, maybe even hundreds of drugs that modulate aspects of the immune system. So from the very beginning, once I got in the lab, it was, I want to figure out what's happening in me. And then I want to see if there's something that exists that can address this problem because I can't develop a new drug from scratch. I don't have the money or the time. And so I think that realization, and I've spent more time in the medical field, it's become more clear that there's this massive gap. You know, once a drug gets FDA approved, and there's an incredible leader in the FDA here in the United States named Janet Woodcock. Janet's been at the FDA for decades. She's the principal deputy director of the FDA right now. And Janet and I have commiserated a lot over the years that the moment that a drug gets an FDA approval, Janet describes R&D as starting to slow down the moment it gets FDA approval. One would expect that it's FDA approved. Let's ramp it up. It's on the market. It's being distributed. Yeah. It's being manufactured. It is available at your CVS or whatever your drugstore may be. But that's when the R&D starts ramping down. And it comes almost a complete halt within 5 years. The last 5 years that a drug is on the market, no R&D is being done to figure out new diseases for that drug. Wait a minute. That's when we should be really, and then once it's generic, there is no work whatsoever once the drug's generic, right? And that's maybe even as humanity, that's when we should be really ramping up our research, right? It's like, it's cheap. It's being manufactured by 10 different manufacturers. It's widely accessible to parts of the world that can't access new drugs. And that's when there's no R&D being done. And so as someone who's alive, thanks to one of these old cheap generic drugs, I am all in on how do we really ramp up and make sure that we're utilizing the tools that we have at hand.
So that's the philosophy behind this Every Cure initiative?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So about a year and a half ago, we launched this new nonprofit called Every Cure, which is trying to address this problem that drugs are not fully utilized for every disease they can treat. Drugs are generally developed for 1 to 3 indications. But the average drug actually has 2 to 3 indications, which means the average drug has already been repurposed at least once. But all of that work stops within a few years of its first approval. So what we're on a mission to do is to say, let's utilize the power of artificial intelligence and all the incredible data and knowledge that's been generated over the years to prioritize among all the possibilities, which drugs for which diseases should we generate more evidence around? So there's 3,000 FDA-approved drugs, and there's about 20,000 human diseases. So if you tried every drug for every disease, you'd have 60 million shots on goal. So we're utilizing 5 different AI algorithms on 5 different biomedical knowledge graphs and data sets to rank order among those 60 million possibilities. What are the top possibilities? And then let's invest funding into evidence generation, whether it's in the lab or in the clinic, to really prove out whether that hypothesis actually works.
Listening to you, I wondered whether there's a parallel with the whole ALS movement.
Well, it's a couple of parallels. One is that, so first off, Brian Wallach is a dear friend of mine. And Brian and I, of course, have empathized with one another a lot over the years. IAMALS is very much in the same vein as what we talked about, the collaborative network approach, right? Where it's patients part of the process, prioritizing what work should be done. And we are sort of, you know, cut from the, you know, the same cloth in that way. One difference is that in ALS, there's been a relentless focus, as there should be, on new drug development. And there's a lot of investment in new drug development. There's been some investment into repurposing for ALS, but I will tell you that there's been less enthusiasm for it, in part because a lot of drugs, as you know, don't cross the blood-brain barrier. So there's sort of an initial, well, most drugs aren't getting across blood-brain barrier, so like, let's not waste our time doing that because we might find something that would work, but it's not going to cross the blood-brain barrier. So let's not waste our time. I agree with that philosophically, but at the same time, I wish we would push the boundaries a little bit more in ALS and say, like, yes, that is true, but there are a lot of drugs that do cross the blood-brain barrier that we've sort of put out of the realm of possibility. And as you're probably well aware, the most recent FDA approval for an ALS drug was a combination of a nutraceutical, so a supplement that's been around for decades, and a generic drug that's been around for decades. And it's effective. It's not curative. It's certainly not as effective as we would like ALS drugs to be. But we proved that two old drugs that have been around for a long time can improve outcomes in ALS with the most recent FDA approval. So, you know, why not look a little bit further?
It's really impressive to hear all the lessons you got out from your experience and now with Every Cure. I think it's like, for me as a young researcher, young scientist now I'm science communicator, but I'm still really connected to young researchers and young labs. I hope, because it really resonates with me, that this will inspire a lot of people rebuilding the way they think about their research, because I can really see how this kind of reshaping the way we think about pre-research on where to get the knowledge and then make prioritization in order then to invest in the right question, because this is one of the questions we ask sometimes. How do you choose the question you work on? So it's, thank you for sharing all that. You decided to write a book about your experience. I have two questions around this. Like, why did you decide to do it? And for who is it for? Public, researcher?
Yeah, great question. So I started testing this drug on myself back in January of 2014. And so I'm closing in on 10 years that I've been on this drug. And for the first couple of years I was on it, I didn't really tell anyone that I was on it. In part because I didn't want other patients to start testing it, or doctors testing it on other patients without us knowing, like, is it helpful? Is it going to cause harm? Like, I was just very afraid. You know, I've got an immune system disorder where my immune system can explode for no reason. And like, I didn't know if maybe mTOR inhibition, actually, maybe mTOR is really activated because there was some compensatory mechanism. And the last thing you want to do is inhibit it. I mean, I didn't know. And so for the first couple of years, I really didn't talk about being on this drug. But in the third year that I was on it, I was driving forward a lot of science and cytokine storm research. And a reporter from the New York Times learned that I was on a drug that I had discovered myself, even though we really hadn't been sharing whatsoever about it. And she decided she wanted to run a story about it. And it ran in February of 2017. Here in the States, it was on Super Bowl Sunday, which is a day that I guess a lot of people read the newspaper. And it ran in the New York Times as a cover story, and it got a tremendous amount of exposure. The title was Doctor, Cure Thyself. And it got a lot of readership. And that next Monday morning, when I looked at my email, I had been contacted by literally dozens of agents and publishers and lots of people in the film and the book industry. And so it was, you know, you need to write a book. And I said, well, I don't have time to write a book. I'm busy trying to figure out this disease. And what they told me is, well, no one who writes a book has time to write a book, right? You know, everyone who writes books is too busy to write a book, but they figure it out. And so I ended up working with Penguin Random House and this amazing editor there. And by the way, I did think about it for long and hard about whether it made sense. And I did at the end decide that I did want to do it. And so I ended up working with Penguin Random House, this amazing editor, and created a process where I worked on the book every Saturday and Sunday for 10 hours on both days. So I'd get 20 hours a week of writing in, but I would not touch it during the week. So on Sunday evening, I would send it to my editor. She would work on it from Monday through Friday. I'd get a version back on Friday. I'd work on it, you know, 20 hours the next weekend. So I was able to keep all of my work moving at full speed while also, you know, over the course of 50 weeks, so 50, 20 hour weekends, I was able to write the book. And the interesting thing is that this is also the last year that my wife and I were just the two of us before our daughter was born. So our daughter was born on August. Yeah,
try finding 20 hours a weekend.
I know, right? Yeah. So my daughter was born on August 19th, and I handed in the book on August 1st, and that was somewhat intentional because I knew that once my daughter arrived, that I was gonna have 20 hours every weekend. But it does mean that I literally spent every free moment of like the last weekend where my wife and I, you know, had an empty house, just the two of us working. But we both, you know, we thought it was the right thing, and it was a big investment of time. And you know, having had my last rites read to me and having nearly died five times, in my opinion, there's nothing more important than how you spend your time and the kind of investments you make of your time. So it was a big investment. I'm really happy I did it. It was written for the lay public. It has gotten a large readership of non-scientists. There are a lot of scientists and physicians who've also read it. And as we discussed today, I think there are some really important lessons for the scientist and the physician. But it was written with the intention of being, you know, sort of broadly applicable. And as was mentioned during the intro, it really took off, became a national bestseller. And there have been some really funny experiences with readers of it. So I'll tell a quick anecdote from March 31st of 2021. So I get this phone call from an unknown number, and I answer. I don't know who it is. Do we celebrate April Fool's Day around the world? Is April 1st a print? Okay, I just so it's the day before April Fool's Day. It's March 31st. I get a call from an unknown number, and I answer it, and the person says, "Hi, I've got President Clinton on the other line. He read your book, and he wants to talk to you." And so it's, you know, it's the day before April Fool's Day. I'm like certain it's a joke. You know, of course it's not President Clinton. So I answer it, and then I hear, "David, it's Bill Clinton." And I'm like, oh my gosh, it really is President Clinton. And of course he's got this, like, you know, this accent that, like, you know, that it's hard to, you know, you basically think it's got to be fake because it's like so pronounced, right? But it really was President Clinton. So he reads about 50 books a year. And he read Chasing My Cure in 21, and he connected on a bunch of levels. So we both went to Georgetown for undergrad. We both went to Oxford for grad school. He loves football. He was in the band at Georgetown. So he watched every Georgetown football game when he was in college. And so we connected on that. He and I both are very connected to Little Rock, Arkansas. I spent a lot of time in the hospital in Little Rock. That's where I spent most of the time that I've been hospitalized in the ICU in Little Rock, because that's where the world's expert for Castleman's is. And so we connected on a bunch of levels. And he basically said, you know, I want to support any way I can. He was really blown away, I think, in the same way a lot of people are, by this idea that the tools that we have within reach, the drugs that are on our pharmacy shelf, are the things that we do the least amount of research on in our whole healthcare system. And he's like, wait a minute, I invested billions of US taxpayer dollars into biomedical research that led to drugs getting FDA approval. And you're telling me that no one is trying to figure out more ways that those FDA approved drugs can help more people? And I'm like, yeah, that's what I'm telling you. It's horrible, but like, that's the system that we're in. And so that really caught his attention. And I think that there's a couple other aspects here too, and particularly related to health equity, which has been equity and access have been big priorities of President Clinton since he's been out of the White House. And so you can imagine old, cheap, generic drugs that are widely accessible all over the world can help us to deal with a lot of health inequities and a lot of issues of access to medication. So anyway, it's become a real priority of his. And we've met in person a few times.
Do you think there's been some real resistance from the pharmaceutical industry to the idea of using old cheap drugs rather than developing new expensive drugs?
Yeah, I think that there's a bit of like a negative connotation when people talk about repurposing, which I think probably in some ways might have been pushed a little bit by drug companies. I don't think there's any sort of conspiracy where they want us to like not use old generic drugs. But I think that we've all seen the marketing, you know, this is the brand new drug that's more selective than the last one, and it's more effective, and it's, you know, costs 500 times more, but, you know, all those things. So we've all heard that. And I think that has, you know, has permeated a bit into the way we think about things. I mean, frankly, as a society, as humanity, we don't necessarily like to recycle things, you know, like old things are sort of old. And like we as humans, I think we like new things. And so it might just be in our DNA that like, you know, that we like the idea of some new selective expensive drug over something that's old and safe. I think there is something to it from pharma. I think that there's also, I think it's a lot of it has to do with incentive systems that we have, you know, in academia, you know, we get incentivized by grants and by papers. And we all know that a new cellular immunotherapy is going to get a higher impact journal publication than a cheap old drug, you know, that you can't, you know, get money to run a clinical trial of, right? So I think there's some aspect of incentives, and yeah, I think probably some aspect from pharma too.
I had another question. If we go back to to one of the specificities of your path, is we asked previously in several episodes to the people, to researchers, what advice they would give to young researchers if they want to be more involved with patients. But can we flip the question around with you and ask if you have any advice? What advice would you have for patients who want to get more involved into research? Is there something we can do here? Is there a good way to see?
Should they be injecting themselves?
So no, do not inject yourselves with medications. Do not do that. Yeah. You know, what is it? You know, do as I say, I do. Yeah, exactly. So I think that some really good advice, and I feel like, you know, during podcasts like this, I can never get in the full story, but a really big part of my story is having a physician partner who is sort of within the medical community. So Fritz Vandry, I mentioned he's the world's expert. He's the person in Little Rock, Arkansas that I went to see. And so Fritz was sort of my partner in crime for research. And so what that meant is that I was just a medical student. I wasn't yet a physician. I was just a medical student who had all these, you know, dreams. But because I had Fritz as my partner in crime, I could send emails to other physicians and researchers, and I could, you know, copy Fritz on it and say, you know, Fritz and I wanted to reach out because we read your paper. Really, I read the paper and I had questions, but Fritz was, you know, it gave me credibility. And so finding a partner, whether it's your doctor or it's someone in the field as a patient that you can do this with, that can give you some credibility. They wouldn't have responded to David Fagenbaum, the medical student, but they responded to David Fagenbaum and Fritz Van Rie because they had heard of Fritz and they knew what he was doing. And he's this amazing myeloma doctor. And so I think that if you're a patient, it's important to recognize that like you will not get the time and the space that you may deserve in our current system, because our current system isn't built. There isn't a place at the table for you. That's just the way the system is. But if you can partner with someone who has a place at the table and you can kind of, you know, squeeze into part of their chair, then I think that's the way to go. And then what you'll do is when you're at the table, you'll impress the rest of the people at the table with your diligence, your hard work, your perspective, your thoughtfulness around impact. And then they're going to pull up a chair and you'll have a seat at the table. But there's just no way you're going to get there unless you have a partner in crime like Fritz.
Are there lots of these stories? You remind me of Sharon Terry. I interviewed her many, many years ago. she, this idea of not accepting no, it's impossible as an answer. So she went and found the genetic mutation in her own children.
Yes.
And set up the genetic alliance.
Yeah, there certainly are a number of folks like this. So Sharon Terry falls in this category. Josh Summer, Josh was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer his freshman year at Duke and dropped out of Duke, and he's made his whole career and his life around chordoma research. And he took a lot of, he never took no for an answer. I think there are a lot of us. And I think we gain strength from hearing one another's stories. Of course, there are a lot of us that have, you know, have trotted on this path that haven't made it, that we didn't find that genetic mutation. We didn't find the drug. But along the way, we learned a lot for the rest of us. And, I remember thinking to myself, it's unlikely I'm going to find a drug, but at least I can, go out swinging. At least I can, do my part to try to get one swing on this castle, man. And so I think there are a lot of us, and I think that all of us, get hope and inspiration and a little extra strength from one another.
So we can see where your drive comes from. I wondered, you so now you're running a lab, right?
Yes.
Publishing papers very successfully. So you haven't mentioned any mentors. Have there been mentors along the way? And we like to hear what sort of mentoring advice you picked up along the way.
Oh my gosh, I have the best mentors in the world. I have spoken on the phone to my primary mentor Arthur Rubenstein, or met him in person every week since May of 2012.
Wow.
So I did the math recently. It's somewhere around 600 meetings that we've had. Early on, they were closer to an hour. Now we knock them out in about 30 minutes. So Arthur Rubenstein is the former dean of the medical school here at Penn. He discovered C-peptide and is this amazing diabetes researcher who has an incredible career in translational research. And he retired as dean of Penn in 2010, which is right around the time that I became ill with my disease. And when I returned from medical leave, and I learned he was actually the interim director of the Penn Orphan Disease Center, I asked if I could be helpful in any way. And this is an interesting example where his administrative assistant said, well, he doesn't have any time to meet with anyone for like 6 months, because he just retired. Everyone's trying to meet with Arthur. Doesn't have time for 6 months. And I just, kept emailing her, Fran, is there anything? And I got a time with her within a couple weeks, or a time with him within a couple weeks. And when I met with him, I brought a plan for the Orphan Disease Center. So he just made the interim director. And I said, Arthur, I've come up with a strategic plan for, what the Orphan Disease Center should look like. Here it is. And he's like, who is this kid? And why is he giving me a strategic plan? What is happening here? And I just told him, I said, I've got an orphan disease. I'm on an orphan drug. This is when I was on that experimental drug, the IL-6 blocker. And, I want to be helpful any way that I can. And so he very graciously said, sure, you can help if you'd like. And so I helped him early on with Orphan Disease Center. And then I relapsed. And that's when he, when I decided I would take on Castleman's, and he committed, he said, I'll be your mentor and I'll support you through this. And so it's been so critical to have someone like Arthur. I think that just for all the listeners, the value that a mentor provides, it's hard for me to like quantify and to sort of put it all together, but a few things that immediately come to mind. So one is that mentors can tell you what to expect on the road that you're going down. So as you're someone like me, I am, a bull in a china shop. I am running with all of my energy. I work all day. Every day, if I've thought about doing something, I have done it. But when you do that, you can, go off the road. You can make a lot of mistakes, right? But having someone like Arthur, he can say, well, actually, 20 yards in front of where you are on the road is a big landmine. Don't do this. And so mentors can be really good for folks like myself that are young and hungry and just go to say, well, be careful of this. Expect this. Let's plan for that. Whereas I would have no idea to plan for, because I haven't run into the roadblock yet. Arthur, he probably never ran into any roadblocks, or he would say that he did because he's a very modest and humble person. But he knew where the roadblocks were in ways that I never could have. And so that's one thing. Another is having a critical eye on everything you do. I think the best mentors are mentors who give you the full story. They don't just tell you, great job, Dave. They say, Dave, you really could have done this better. And you really should have thought about this other way. And I know where you were coming from, but I didn't like that approach. And so, you know, I played college football, and that's something that you, in sports, you have coaches who are constantly criticizing you. A lot more criticism than you know, positive affirmations. And I think that criticism, constructive criticism from someone who you trust, and you know that they're just giving you that criticism because they care about you and they care about your vision and they care about your success. And so I think it's about roadblock, navigation. It's about having that sort of critical eye looking at the work you're doing, giving you the feedback you need. And then I think the third thing is it also gives you a tremendous amount of confidence, or gave me a lot of confidence in my decision. So we would have a tough decision. Do we work with this company or that company? Do we do this or that? And after spending 30 minutes working through it with Arthur and coming to a decision, I now felt more confident in my decision than I would have if I had come up with the answer on my own. So I could then move forward with confidence, knowing that, you know, this is something that we've really pressure tested. So cannot overemphasize enough how important mentorship is.
Thank you for all those precious tips. We can definitely feel the passion and the thing. And you really appreciate it to have those mentors around you.
Oh, and, yes.
We cannot stress enough this in the podcast, but thank you for doing it again and in your own way. What are examples of qualities that people need to work in effective translation research? Do you have any insight on that?
Without necessarily being ill first.
Yeah. Don't make yourself sick or test drugs in yourself. We'll leave those two things out. I think that it's a lot of things that I think are going to be important for success, regardless of what field you're in. I think that you've got to have a really clear vision for what you're working towards. You have to know. Like, of course, none of us know the results of our experiments, and that's fine. There's no way to know. That's why we do the experiments. But you got to know what you're working towards. You got to know, how does this experiment fit into the bigger picture? So that's one. You know, I think having that really clear big picture view for what you're working towards. Another is don't chase the funding. I found that my colleagues that are, you know, same place as me in my career have really gotten sidetracked by doing research and pursuing studies because that's where the grant funding was. It's not really what they were interested in. It's not really where the science was directing them, but that's where the money is. I really recommend against that. I really believe that if you do good science and you're asking questions that are meaningful to you and to others, to stay the track, you know, keep doing that. Don't veer into another lane just to, you know, pick up funding, because in actuality, it'll make it harder to then get back into the lane that you were in, because you're going to be distracted. So I think clear picture, don't chase the money, stay focused. I think focus, focus, focus. You might hear me talking today and be like, David doesn't sound focused at all. He runs a lab, he runs a center, and he runs this Evercure thing. The reality is that I've been able to expand my focus areas a bit because I built really great teams around each of these. So I've got a nearly 20-member lab here at Penn that's focused on hyperinflammatory diseases. I've got a great team focused on Castleman's in particular, and now we're building out a 30 to 40-member team around Evercure. And so that enables me to do more, but it's only because I've got great people. So I guess that next thing would be delegation, but delegation to great people. Don't delegate to not great people. and you have to be aware that there are all-stars and there are not all-stars. And it's really hard to sort of come to that realization. But one sort of trick that I learned, or at least motto, is slow to hire, quick to fire. And that isn't necessarily like the sunniest way of looking at life and work, because, you know, we all want everyone to be happy and we want everyone to work out in every job. But the reality is that, you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to make discoveries that will result in lives saved. And so if someone is not the right fit, the best thing you can do for them and for your program and for patients who could benefit from your work is to find another opportunity for them that may not be in your lab. So, I think those are sort of a handful of things that come to mind for what I think is helpful in a translational researcher.
This has been amazing. Thanks, David. We're going to take a short break. And then after the break, we're going to hear a little bit more about life outside the lab.
Hey, folks, don't run away. You're listening to The Lonely Pipette with Renaud Pourpre and Jonathan Weissman, where our goal is to help scientists do better science.
If you're enjoying the show and you want to learn more, you can follow us on Twitter at LonelyPipette. And please share the podcast with your friends.
If you don't want to miss any of our future episodes, you can subscribe to our mailing list and join our community. Click on the subscription link on our Twitter account.
It's as simple as that. Take a few moments to get more tips from the Lonely Pipette. Welcome back. You're listening to the Lonely Pipette with David Feigenbaum. You told us about your amazing story and how you cured yourself. And now in the second half, we want to hear a little bit more about you, maybe outside of this the lab and this translational research. So we like to start with a question. Do you have a morning routine? What does it look like when David wakes up in the morning? What happens?
So I've got a 5-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son, and my 5-year-old daughter sleeps in bed with my wife and I every night. She comes in the room at about 1 a.m. And so I wake up with my 5-year-old sort of like poking me in the shoulder at about 6 a.m. saying, "Daddy, daddy, wake up." Because the mornings are for me and my kids. And so my wife, sleeps in a little bit longer. And so, you know, my 5-year-old pokes my shoulder. We roll out of bed. I go grab our 2-year-old, who's usually hanging out in his crib talking to himself, and bring them downstairs. And we spend, an hour and a half together, just the three of us. It might be playing with some of their stuffed animals, eating a little bit of breakfast. Sometimes we do exercises together, where I'll have like my kids sort of hang on my back while I do pushups. That's what my morning looks like. It's a three of us, and my wife comes down.
So how early does that start?
From 6 till 8 a.m. It's me and my two little ones. I call them my pookies. So it's me and my pookies from 6 till 8.
You reminded me of the time when my kids were that age and we had more than two, and you never knew who you're going to wake up with or in which room you're going to wake up. So
exactly.
Yeah, it was crazy nights. What happens at the end of the day? How do you wind down? Because I can see that the days are very intense, right?
Yeah, they are. So I usually drive to work by around 8:30, and so I'm sort of in work mode. I'm on my first call by 8:30, and I'm done and at home by 6:30. So 8:30 to 6:30 is work. I sort of bookend the day with calls for the drives, and so I get back home at 6:30. And my wife's very serious about 6:30, not 6:31. My daughter comes to the door and says, "Daddy, it's 6:31." I say, I know, hon. I tried really hard. I did. So 6:30 is when I get home. Occasionally 6:31, and then once we get home, it's dinner and bath and bedtime for the kids. And so, got the two kids, get them ready for bed. And, I put my 5-year-old to bed. My wife puts our 2-year-old to bed. And so I'm with them, mostly my 5-year-old, about like 8:30 at night. I get a few hours each day with my kids, which is really special.
So you mentioned before that amazingly that you almost died 5 times. I don't think I've met anyone who's ever said that, but
I haven't either.
How has that changed your approach to life? So you mentioned the importance of time.
Yeah, it's changed everything. There, I guess a few things that come to mind. So one, definitely time. In sports, you all both be very familiar with the concept of overtime. So, in a sporting match, there's overtime, time that you didn't think you'd have. And in overtime, there's this incredible preciousness to every moment of overtime. Because, if you mess up in the first half of the game, you can make up for it. You mess up in overtime, the game's over, right? And so there's this real focus in overtime. And that's how I feel like I've been in for, the last 13 years, right? I've been in I'm in my fifth overtime now for 13 years, my 13th year of my fifth overtime. And so there's this incredible clarity in terms of I do what I want to do. I don't do what I don't want to do. If it's not one of those things I want to do, I'm not doing it. And there's a confidence that comes with that, because it's like, hey, when the clock's running out, you just do the things that you want to do. That's the whole old adage, live like you're dying, right? It's that that certainly has percolated into my life. So that's one piece. I think that, you know, another way that it's changed me is, you know, just really, you know, being very focused on family and friends. You know, as I think about the times when I was on my deathbed, I mean, the things I was thinking about were my family and my friends and the people I was hugging, you know, family and friends. And that's what was sort of all encompassing. And, you know, so that sort of gives you a shock that's like, okay, well, that's the stuff that really matters. And you can imagine hearing, you know, what we talked about, I get really into my work. And so it's this sort of constant sort of, you know, back and forth that I've got to remind myself of, you know, what are the things that you really need to focus on?
It's interesting because we had a question for you about making choices. You know, in research, we feel that we have the time, we explore every type of hypothesis, like we make the decision to make sometimes to not make a real one in order to explore everything. So how do you apply this maybe to your own research? Like is there specific tips you can get out from it, like to decide what's the best next step for you? Like is there something you can decipher from that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a few things come to mind. So the first is that I really do, and I'll use the word crowdsource, but I really do turn to a lot of people for advice on these sorts of decisions in ways that at least the people I turn to tell me it's a bit unusual. Like, you know, usually we like to keep things, you know, within our lab to ourselves, and we might turn to a few other people. But I like to tell a lot of people what I'm thinking. I like to get a lot of feedback. And the best thing about feedback is you don't have to use it all, right? You know, the more feedback you get to decide what feedback you're going to use. And so I like to spread the questions out wide, and hopefully all the wonderful people who have been generous with their feedback aren't listening to this podcast and upset with me for giving
feedback. Oh, David, he never listens. Yeah.
Yeah. I know, right? So please don't write that in on the social media post. But truly, you know, I think it's about getting feedback because, you know, none of us know the right answer. If we did, we wouldn't do the work that we do. So I think getting, you know, feedback from a lot of people is really important. And then I think the other thing is that I do often put my patient lens on and say, you know, if this experiment turns out to be positive, what would that mean for me as a patient? And if it turns out to be negative, what would that mean for me as a patient? And if neither a negative or positive is going to be theoretically even meaningful, and it doesn't have to be right away. I mean, every experiment we do is not going to have a meaningful impact on patients. But if there's not a path from that positive or negative to something that could be meaningful for a patient, that's going to make me deprioritize it. We do some basic science work in our lab, and I really value the importance of basic science work. But in our very translational lab, we add that extra filter, which is just, you know, is this going to get us somewhere?
Super interesting. Thank you. We explored a lot of topics with you, and you shared already quite a lot. But is there something about you that people would be surprised to discover still?
Yeah, I think that, and somehow this didn't end up in my book, and it should have. And that's that I don't know how to ride a bike. And, you know, and maybe even worse okay. than I don't know how to ride a bike is that I forgot how to ride a bike. I actually learned how to ride a bike as a child, and I fell.
You never forget. They say you never forget.
That's what they say. That's what they say. But I'm telling you, you can forget how to ride a bike. I got up from falling down. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, I'm never going to ride a bike again. I mean, I really hurt myself. I'm never going to do this thing ever again. And it was like 25 wow. years that went by before I got back on a bike. And I learned that actually it's hard to get back on the bike after you haven't done it in a while. So yeah, I think that the reason that would be surprising in particular is that I think people talk about, you know, getting back up on the bike, you know, being perseverant, you know, and resilient. But I guess in my case, I'm more I don't know if I'm narrow-minded, but I'm more like laser. If I make a decision, that is my decision that I am resilient.
So can you think of any regrets during this impressive career?
Yeah, good question. I think my biggest regret is something that I am trying to work on now, and that's that, you know, the last 9 years I have worked so hard. And this isn't me. This isn't like in a job interview where you say like, what's your biggest weakness is I work too hard. I'm not saying that. When I say like I work too hard, like I work like 70, 80 hours a week and no one's asking me to, right? Like that's just what I do. That's like who I am. I work more than anyone I've ever seen anyone. I've never seen anyone else work as many hours as I work. And so, yeah, the regret is that a lot of that time, you know, was time that I could have been with Caitlin, could have been with my young kids. I actually just looked at the calendar for this last year, been traveling a ton with the launch of EveryCure. We've been out on the road fundraising for EveryCure, and we've fortunately been able to hit our goals. So I'm going to be able to really throttle back. But I spent nearly half of the last year on the road. And my son's just turned two. You know, I spent almost half of his second year on the planet out of the house. And so it's something I'm correcting right now. And I'm really going to try to be very intentional about it. I'm going to start, you know, putting time blocks in my calendar that like family time that can't be, you know, adjusted. Because, yeah, I think that's my biggest regret right now is that I don't think that I've made the time for my family and also for my friends that I would like to make. And so I'm working on that.
So we always ask about how do you get life work balance, but lots of our guests say there is no balance. So.
There is no balance. But I think that it's something I really want to work on. And you know, if you have me back on the podcast, I don't know how long from now, I will tell you then that I've done a better job. I'm committed to it because, yeah, it's so important. And I think that, you know, I've gotten so focused on so many scientific goals, and thankfully we've been able to hit a lot of these scientific goals. And now I've really been able to build out the kind of team where I don't think I need to work 70 to 80 hours a week. I think I can work a more normal amount of hours because we've got such a great team in place. So anyway, I'm committing to all of the listeners and to both of you.
We'll get you back when you've cured another dozen diseases and injected yourself with other things. Yeah.
So we have a few fire question now. So we are going just to send it to you, and then you can just answer as you feel. If you could have dinner with one. If you could have dinner with one person, living or dead, who would it be and why?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, and maybe I should just go with the first answer, is Benjamin Castleman. So Benjamin Castleman, you know, he described Castleman disease. Of course, it's been around forever, but he was the person back in the 1950s who made this observation that it, like these sort of disparate cases where they thought they had lymphoma, they didn't have lymphoma, but they were really sick and it looked like they were going to die, but it wasn't lymphoma. He was able to make the observation that these all seemed to be the same thing, and he brought them together. He didn't name it Castleman disease. He named it angiofollicular lymph node hyperplasia, but that just doesn't have a good ring to it. So, you know, so someone decided to change it to name it after him. You know, I would love to spend some
time
with
him. When did he die? When did he live?
He died. So he made the discovery back in the mid 50s. He also was a real pioneer in a number of plasmacytic neoplasia. He actually made a number of really important discoveries for diseases like Waldenstrom's and multiple myeloma. He passed away, I believe. Actually, it's on my wall. I have a picture of him over there. I just can't quite see the date, but I do have a picture of him.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I believe he passed somewhere around 20 years ago. But he actually passed away from Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, a disease that he made a lot of progress against in his scientific life. And so there are these connections that I have with him. Obviously, he discovered and described my disease, but also he ended up succumbing to a disease that he did a lot of his own research on. I actually got a chance to meet his grandchildren in Boston a few years ago, which for me was a really, really touching moment.
Now, if you had $1 million or euros, but for you it's more like dollars, I think, to spend in science, but not in experiments, how would you spend them?
I would undoubtedly 100% spend those dollars on a system to match drugs against diseases that they're not yet utilized for. I think that there's no more important use. I like to think about this analogy, and you know, I've used some sports analogies here. Rob Califf is the commissioner of the FDA here in the U.S., and he talks about new drug development as being like soccer, and I think you all know soccer. A lot of shots on goal. Occasionally, it goes in the net. Usually it goes in the net because it bounced off of someone and it's sort of like something happened weird and it actually got in the net. That's soccer, right? And that's new drug development, in my opinion. You know, 10% of the time it bounces off of a leg and it ends up in the goal, right? That's new drug development. Repurposing, which is what we're talking about, is, in my opinion, is more like American football, where you're on the 5-yard line. You're 5 yards from the end zone. All you have to do is just get it those last 5 yards. Now, the last 5 yards actually can sometimes be the hardest 5 yards, because everyone is, you know, knows what you're doing, and you're only 5 yards out, and the defense is ready, and it's hard, but you're 5 yards out, you know, like, punch it in the end zone. And so, I think that, you know, we've got to have the system that doesn't necessarily help you punch in the end zone, but it helps you to figure out which are the ones that are on the 5-yard line that we need to punch into the end zone, that we need to do the clinical trials on, we need to do further laboratory research on. So that sort of platform, and of course, you know, it's a bit of a spoiler alert, but that's what we're building with every cure, is this platform to match drugs and diseases. And it actually will cost more than $1 million. But I think that, you know, this sort of process of matching drugs and diseases, I can't think of anything more important than let's get the things that are on the 5-yard line in the end zone.
I wondered whether your sporting analogy is a metaphor for European versus American funding systems. So it's a little bit like that.
You know, I didn't say it. I didn't say it. You know,
no one said it. Okay. Let me ask another question at the other end. Can you think of a purchase of $100 or less that has really impacted your life?
Oh, for sure. It's an easy one. So that immunohistochemistry experiment I ran with phospho-6 cost $36. I literally confirmed increased mTOR signaling in my lymph node and our controls for $36. And of course, we've done it across, you know, many more patients, and we've used orthogonal approaches, and it's cost way more than $36 to orthogonally validate. But the initial experiment, $36.
Wow.
Well spent.
Best $36 spent. I've ever spent.
Plus the syringe.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. The syringe. Yeah. The syringe, that's a good one, too.
So do you have a sentence on your lab door? And if you don't, what would it be?
I don't have one on my lab door, this is sort of, you know, off the cuff, but it would be something to the effect of we are where patients, well, this isn't very eloquent. It's something to the effect of we're the place where patients go when they're out of hope, and we create hope by turning that hope into action. You know, we are the place, you know, where patients go, yeah, when there is no hope, and we create hope by finding existing solutions. That again, it's not very catchy and it's way too wordy, but that's the essence of it, is that we want to be where there is no hope. We want to work in the space where no one knows what to do and where there aren't options. And we want to create hope with tools that are within reach.
So we're going to wrap up. And one of the last questions we always ask, I'm just looking at the question, I'm wondering how it applies. So we normally ask people, what advice would you give to yourself if you met yourself 20 years ago? Which I particularly poignant, yes, for you. Yeah.
Yeah. If 20 years ago it said, keep doing what you're doing. Do not stop. Like just do all the things you're going to do. Don't stop. Don't slow down. Don't decide about another career. Don't go into business, because it's not going to be good for you. You know, like, stick on your path. Like, go to grad school, go to medical school. You're going to need every minute of that training, and it is going to come in handy at the exact moment. But if you do anything different, if you take a 1-month vacation, if you take a semester off, none of it will work out. So just do exactly what you're going to do and don't question it.
I love it.
That's great.
Thank you, David. It's been so great to spend this moment with you. We have two last questions just for you to share.
Sure.
A little bit. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Sure. So you can go to chasingmycure.com. That's where we sort of track the story of my journey, Chasing My Cure. It's where you can learn more about the book, and you can follow and find my social media handles. To learn more about EveryCure, you can go to everycure.org. And to learn more about our Castleman's work, you can go to cdcn.org.
Yeah, we'll put all of that in the show notes. And is there anything else you would like to add to finish this episode?
Thank you to both of you for having me on your podcast. This has been so much fun. I have the opportunity to do these sorts of things fairly often, and this is certainly up there with one of the most fun ones that I've ever done. And I think it's because both of you thread this needle in terms of talking about, in-depth science and impact on patients, but also, the humanity of this whole thing, which, as we all know, sometimes gets lost in, our relentless pursuit of science. So I love that you ask questions on both sides of things. So a really big thank you to both of you. And I think that maybe I would just put a call to action to all the listeners. And that is, if you are in biomedical research, which I suspect most of you are, I really encourage you to think about the tools that are within reach, the drugs that are already on the pharmacy shelf. And if you're doing animal model work or working in vitro systems, and you're thinking about a new oligo or some new gene therapy, think about those new things, but also think about, is there something that already exists, maybe a cheap generic drug that might be available in parts of the world that some of these newer agents won't be available, and test those out too.
Not on yourself.
Test them out in your model system, and that model system should not be you. So I think, think about those existing drugs, and I hope you all will help to champion what we're doing. With every cure, it's a bit outside the box, certainly unconventional. We're going to certainly get pushback from a lot of people in the system. But I hope those of you that are listening today that, like to listen to Lonely Pipette and like to listen to these sorts of questions are the kinds of people and researchers that'll be on our side cheering for us and helping to raise awareness for every cure and this really audacious belief that we can utilize existing drugs in new ways, even when there's no financial incentive. And so I hope you'll be cheerleaders, and I hope you all will also be partners. So reach out to me. It's easy to find me, david@everycure.org, and it's easy to find us online. Please do reach out if you think there might be ways that we could partner.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, David. Thanks for so much of your time. It was fantastic.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you for joining us at The Lonely Pipette.
We hope that you learned something new, that something resonated with your own experiences, or that you just enjoyed the science.
Let us know your thoughts on Twitter @LonelyPipette. And please, share it with your friends in the lab. If you want to join our community, you can subscribe to The Lonely Pipette mailing list or mail us by following the link available on our Twitter profile. You will receive the next episodes directly in your mailbox. How cool is that?
Stay tuned for the next show, and remember, you might feel like a lonely pipette, but it doesn't mean you're alone. Tips from the Lonely Pipette can help you to do better science.
A bientôt!
A bientôt!